today's Education Matters moderator.
Good morning. This is John Nicholson. Welcome to Education Matters. Today I'm at Park High School, and I'm going to interview and chat with a colleague of many, many years. We go back together to about 1982, we're going to talk about the role of the job coach position in the high school. If you hear background noise, we are sitting in the upstairs part of the library at Park High School, and school is in opt-in process. Connie, hi. Good to be with you.
Hi, John. Nice to see you again.
That's very good. Connie, you have a breadth of educational experience in the district. Let's kind of talk about it. When you came to the district, when was that? Where were you, and what were you doing?
I came to the district when I was about 10 years old. That's the only way I can do the math. I started subbing in the fall of 1977. I was just fresh out of Lawrence University. Mm-hmm. I had done my undergraduate work in music and in history, and vowed when I started at Lawrence that I didn't know what I was going to do, but I was not going to be a teacher. After a couple of educational classes to improve my grade point average, I student taught and found the moment I was standing in front of a classroom that I had found my home, and that, oh yes, I was too going to be a teacher.
Okay. So it was actually the experience of teaching that gave you the motivation to become a teacher.
It just felt right.
Okay, and your experience in Racine Unified as a teacher, let's talk about your early days there.
I started out doing daily subbing in the fall of 1977 and had quite a variety of very funny experiences. Mm. I remember once trying to teach a band full of students who had only gotten their instruments a week before and trying to find one note on which we could tune. Mm-hmm. And after we found one note they could all play, time was up, time to go back to class. Then in the spring of 1978, I was doing a long-term sub position at Horlick High School. Mm-hmm. And then the fall of 1978, I was finally offered a contract. I started at Gifford when it was a junior high.
Okay, Gifford, yeah, at that time was a junior high school. Okay, and your assignment there?
I was doing 8th grade social studies and 9th grade social studies. And I was there for 3 years. Then they decided, in their infinite wisdom, to turn it into an elementary school. Mm-hmm. And we all said at the time, wouldn't it be better just to build an elementary school right here on this site and keep this as a junior high? Well, they're finally doing what we thought they should have done.
Yes,
because now
finally,
we are building a new middle school
new
on
middle
that
school.
Same site, and it has been needed since the 1970s.
The opposite of what you thought they should do.
Well, think of the money we would have saved.
Absolutely.
Because we wouldn't have had to refurbish. We wouldn't have had to turn that into an elementary mm-hmm. school and now turn around and build a new middle school when it already was an excellent setup.
Editorially speaking, I've been to Gifford quite a few times, and I'm thinking, you know, I go in the band room, I go in the choir room, and I think, what a waste of space, you know. But anyway, Gifford became an elementary school, and what happened to you?
And I was sent to Mitchell Middle School, which you know did not compare as far as the resources that mm-hmm. were at Gifford. Mm-hmm. But when I got to Mitchell, what I found was a home.
Okay.
I found a community of students and staff that just were spectacular. I mm-hmm. ended up loving Mitchell mm-hmm. so much that I stayed there for more than 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
At Mitchell, again, I taught 8th and 9th grade social studies. When we transformed it into a middle school, then my teaching duties were just 8th grade U.S. history. And loved it for all the years mm-hmm. that I was at Mitchell.
We'll come back to that, but I want to talk with you about the community that you said, you know, the community of students. Let's talk about that. What made you feel that sense of community?
It's hard to describe, but I felt like they were, I'd say mostly lower middle class students, mm-hmm. but the work ethic for most of them was mm-hmm. there. The feeling of community was there, the feeling of acceptance. We had a lot of very different types of people and students there, but they generally pulled together and worked together. I really loved it.
Okay. And I'll ask the same question about community of staff.
The staff there worked very hard to keep that building going under many, many difficult circumstances. Mm-hmm. And I think as a result, built a resilience that allowed them to use their leadership skills always mm-hmm. with the student in mind. Whatever was the best for the student is what drove mm-hmm. all of our decision making. Mm-hmm. And as Good. Much as we were allowed, that's what we did.
Okay. So you and I met in 1982, which was your first year at Mitchell. And I know you shared a classroom with me. That's how we got to know each other. And then I left Mitchell for other paths and places and came back in, what was that, 1995. And so we ran into each other again, and you were doing some very interesting things that I had not seen in any other school, you and your fellow teachers. And I'd like you to talk about that. You know, for example, your arrangement of the classroom, how you arranged the education, teaching and learning processes, and then some of the spectacular things you did to bring social studies to an end at the end of the school year. Long question, but go ahead.
Okay, and I would like to thank you very much for leaving me the rubber snake in your drawer that I found when I was sharing the classroom with you. That's a memory I won't forget. By the time you came back, the social studies program had developed quite a bit. I had worked with a couple of different partners, and I think by the time you came back, it was Suzanne Egan, who
yes.
was my team teacher.
Mm-hmm.
The teacher prior to that and I had been able to design a new space. There
mm-hmm.
actually was a new wing built, and we built a room designed exactly the way we wanted it. It was designed for team teaching, so
mm-hmm.
it was really a double classroom with a movable wall. And by the time Suzanne Egan came, that wall was rarely in place.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, she and I worked together. We found our talents and our drive were so well meshed
mm-hmm.
that we were able to develop, a spectacular
mm-hmm.
history curriculum for our students.
Mm-hmm.
Veronica Davalos, please go to room 258. Veronica Davalos,
and it's passing
please
time
go to room 258.
So we hear that kind of thing, but this is school in
Toscano,
the middle of the day.
Please come to the main
okay,
office.
Go ahead.
So one of the things that I think we're most proud of is the fact that our entire 8th grade staff got on board to do a Civil War reenactment
mm-hmm.
That really did bring history alive for our students. It involved all disciplines, English,
mm-hmm.
math, social studies, and science. Our music director
mm-hmm.
at that time brought the band out, and students played Civil War music. We got the help of some reenactors
mm-hmm.
who made it truly living history for our students for a day. And on the days when it did not rain, it was a fabulous experience that most of the students that I see,
yeah.
they still remember that. That's their most memorable
sure.
day of middle school.
I know, you gave me the job of getting the weather squared away after the first year when it did pour. But why don't you walk through the day from you know, the time the kids arrived until the end of the day?
Sure. Students were assigned to a particular state,
mm-hmm.
and then they were, when we got to Sanders Park, they were assigned to a reenactor who was in charge of them for the day.
Mm-hmm.
The reenactor led them through boot camp-like activities, taught them to march, follow orders,
mm-hmm.
And really made it feel as though the students had joined the military
mm-hmm.
for the day. Then we would reenact two different battles. One of them, it's been a while now. I can't
okay.
remember the name of the battle. Chancellorsville.
Yeah.
Chancellorsville, which allowed the Southern reenactors to win one. That's
mm-hmm.
the main reason we had to do Chancellorsville.
Okay. Sure.
Then students would do small group activities where
mm-hmm.
the reenactors would tell them about daily life in during the Civil War. In particular, we always had a woman come and talk about what it would be like to be a woman
mm-hmm.
during the war. Then we would do Gettysburg,
mm-hmm.
Pickett's Charge in particular.
Wow, yeah.
Then our students put together a memorial ceremony
mm-hmm.
where students would give speeches. The theme was always freedom
mm-hmm.
is not free.
Mm-hmm.
And they would connect their learning to what is happening now. Mm-hmm. The main thing that I noticed is that when we started this reenactment, it was right before, right during the very first Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
And most of our students had no idea about what war was, and we heard a lot of flip comments, like, mm-hmm. well, why don't we just bomb them all?
Yeah.
And what has changed over the years is that our students understand what mm-hmm. war is now. Mm-hmm. When I ask them how many know someone who's serving in the military, I see two-thirds of the hands go mm-hmm. up, mm-hmm. and my heart falls, there's a seriousness to this mm-hmm. activity mm-hmm. that these students bring now mm-hmm. that wasn't there when we started it.
I can say I understand that, because for several of those experiences, I was there at the end of the day to hear the speeches and see the effects that it had on the kids. I mean, they came back a somber, thoughtful group.
Teachers,
at the end of that experience.
Teachers, please secure your doors. We're having a hall sweep. Students, okay. Report your sub-school for a tardy pass.
There we go. If you're not on time, you get caught in the hall sweep. Okay, so we did the Civil War, and then in the years after I left, because I decided to retire, what happened in terms of your experiences at Mitchell and thereafter?
I think that Suzanne and I just worked very diligently mm-hmm. on our curriculum, and I think especially working towards building real teamwork among the eighth grade classes. Mm-hmm. And then 3 years ago, the director of curriculum moved up mm-hmm. for social studies. Mm-hmm. Jeff Blaga moved up, and he asked me if I would take over his former duties as coordinator of social studies. Mm-hmm. And although I did not particularly feel like leaving Mitchell, I felt if someone asked me to do a different mm-hmm. job, that I should probably take on that challenge.
Yes.
So I served as social studies coordinator for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
I tried diligently to get more up-to-date resources for mm-hmm. our teachers, tried to get them the support that they needed.
Mm-hmm.
We're moving towards implementing Common Core, and there's a lot to be done with that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a big need there.
Sure.
Did that for 2 years, and then our district decided we didn't need individual curriculum coordinators mm-hmm. anymore, and mm-hmm. I was reassigned as a educator effectiveness coach, which is an excellent fit for me. I do.
Which
like
is
that.
What you're doing now.
That's what I'm doing now here at Park.
Okay. We'll talk about that, but I have to interject. I came to Mitchell to work as a substitute principal one day, and I was shocked to learn that you weren't there, because I thought this was your place. But, you know, people move on, and you had an opportunity, and you felt, you know, they came to you, and it was a reasonable thing. But let's talk about the educator effectiveness position now. Give me the objectives of it.
The main objective is that I am supposed to support teachers here at school
mm-hmm.
in any way that I can.
Okay. Do the teachers come to you? Do you seek them out? What is the process of you getting acquainted with the people with whom you work?
It's a little of both.
Okay.
My first few weeks here, I deliberately spent time just getting to know people and
mm-hmm.
building relationships and having conversations with people. I have done a lot of inviting.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a lot of asking to be invited
mm-hmm.
into classrooms. I use every tool that I can think of
mm-hmm.
to try to connect with teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Many teachers do just come and see me on a drop-in basis, and I will help them with whatever it is that they need.
Mm-hmm.
I do provide large group professional development
mm-hmm.
on occasion.
Mm-hmm.
I provide small group professional development
mm-hmm.
A little bit more often. A lot of it is one-on-one work with teachers.
Sure. Are you finding that the majority of teachers you see, are they the younger ones, the newer teachers, people new to the profession, or is it across the board?
I would say that the addition of the educator effectiveness
mm-hmm.
Evaluation tool
mm-hmm.
is driving a lot of the older teachers to me, as well as the younger teachers, because it is something new, something we haven't had
mm-hmm.
to do in the past,
mm-hmm.
and the learning curve is pretty steep.
Yeah.
So I'm seeing everybody.
I interviewed the people that were in charge of the educator effectiveness, excuse me, during the summer prior to the implementation. So we're talking about basically, give me a quick review of that process.
Sure. The educator effectiveness model is a new evaluation tool.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in an effort to measure good teaching,
mm-hmm.
which sounds like an oxymoron. Mm-hmm. Because if you really think about it, teaching is an art.
Yes.
How do you measure art?
Right, right.
Very difficult to do. A woman named Danielson developed a rubric in which she identified four domains mm-hmm. of teaching. One is planning, one mm-hmm. is the classroom environment, one is instruction, mm-hmm. and one is professionalism.
Mm-hmm.
Within those domains, there are 22 components.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are examples of things that you would see mm-hmm. in a classroom. This rubric is intended to help people see themselves and to identify exactly where they are and what kind of teaching mm-hmm. they're providing for their students.
Mm-hmm.
The rubric allows for four levels of performance.
Mm-hmm.
There is an unsatisfactory, we don't see much mm-hmm. of that.
Yeah.
There's a basic level, there's a proficient level, and then a distinguished level.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that most of the teachers fall into the proficient level.
Mm-hmm.
What I like about this rubric is that if you are a really good teacher, you would look at yourself probably in level three
mm-hmm.
and see what the characteristics are. But your eyes stray over to level four,
yeah.
distinguished,
uh-huh.
and you say, I could do that.
Yeah. And you want to do that. You want
to
be there.
Oh, mm-hmm. most teachers are self-driven. Most
sure.
teachers want to improve
mm-hmm.
and will do anything
mm-hmm.
they can to
mm-hmm.
improve what's happening
mm-hmm.
in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
This gives them specific things that they could add to their practice that can lead them to that distinguished
mm-hmm.
level.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a little bit more specific
mm-hmm.
and gives teachers concrete ways
mm-hmm.
to improve their practice.
Now, are you using this as you work with teachers, or are you getting information that has come to you via administrators that have done the evaluation?
I'm using the instrument itself.
Okay.
This is new to administrators, too.
Yes.
So sometimes my job is coaching administrators
okay.
as well as teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I see my job as to become an expert
mm-hmm.
in this new model.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm supporting anybody who needs help
okay.
in any way I can.
Okay, okay. Suppose I am a teacher, and let's just say that I'm kind of fresh out of college, and you come in to watch me, or principal comes in to watch me, or I figure out what's happening myself and come to see you, and my issue is under the realm of teacher-student relationships and specifically behavior management. And I say to you, Ms. Sislak, my kids aren't out of control, but they just are not interested in anything that I'm doing, and they're spending their time on their devices, talking to each other, writing notes, etc. So why don't you walk through the process of working with me?
Sure. And I want you to keep in mind that the coach has developed an acronym for what we do.
Okay.
C is for confidential conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are teachers and not evaluators,
okay.
teachers feel safe
mm-hmm.
coming to talk to us.
Mm-hmm.
O means offer options.
Mm-hmm.
So I would offer a new teacher some ideas,
mm-hmm.
and they would have to implement it.
Okay.
The A stands for assist, so
mm-hmm.
I will find the resources
mm-hmm.
to help teachers. C stands for cheerlead
okay.
or collaborative,
mm-hmm.
and then H is for honesty.
Okay.
The idea is that teachers really need to come up with what will work for them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to prescribe something in particular
mm-hmm.
for a teacher and say, here, do this,
okay.
I've solved your problem, because
okay.
we find that often advice is toxic.
Sure.
Instead, I would provide the resources,
oh, mm-hmm.
Explanations, and then serve as a mirror
okay.
to reflect to the teacher
okay.
what I'm seeing,
mm-hmm.
and then they can choose their next steps.
Okay.
And I would be there to assist them.
Okay.
There are a lot of things that we can do to improve student engagement.
Mm-hmm.
It's a complicated thing, though. It
yeah.
involves an excellent lesson plan.
Mm-hmm.
It involves setting your classroom expectations.
Mm-hmm.
That would be domain two.
Mm-hmm.
And it involves the way you actually deliver your instruction.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to segregate one of those
sure.
from the other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of my job, is just to be there with the resources mm-hmm. and the support, and also a little pat on the back
sure.
saying, you know, keep mm-hmm. at it, you'll mm-hmm. get it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, you know, the structure of the lesson. What do you feel are the components of a well-thought-out, well-delivered lesson plan?
In my mind, there has to be a reason for the lesson.
Okay.
And if you don't convince your students that this is an important lesson mm-hmm. and that there's a reason we need to learn this.
Okay.
And connect it to them.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be fighting an uphill battle.
Sure.
Another thing that needs to be established besides planning an excellent lesson plan mm-hmm. is you have to establish respect and rapport with your students.
Okay, good.
And if you show them that you respect them
mm-hmm.
and you insist on a respectful classroom, and you mm-hmm. have to insist
yes.
on a respectful classroom,
mm-hmm.
everybody should feel respected there.
Mm-hmm.
Those are two very important battles that mm-hmm. the teacher has got to win
mm-hmm.
in order to do any of the things you need to do.
Mm-hmm. So the old adage is, I'm the teacher, I'm an authority, you have to respect me. That's kind of gone by the wayside, and it becomes the relationship between the teacher and the student that the teacher initiates. Is that a fair way to look at it?
I think we have said over and over again, the only way to get respect is to give it. And
mm-hmm.
that's true of teachers, too.
Mm-hmm.
And students can sense in a moment
yeah.
whether you are someone who respects them or
mm-hmm.
not.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't give it to them,
mm-hmm.
they're not going to give it
mm-hmm.
to you. And you can't demand it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to earn it.
Mm-hmm.
Both the
mm-hmm.
students and the teacher have to earn that respect.
In terms of the components of the lesson, what kind of activities in a good lesson do you see? I mean, from the time you mentioned that the teacher has to establish the importance of the lesson, and I would imagine that's, you know, a usual beginning because
mm-hmm.
every day is a little bit different. But then as the class period goes along, what kinds of things do you like to see in a well-structured lesson? I'm thinking of one of my college professors who had a folder, and he said, now remember the last time, and then he would talk for the entire, now we're talking about a college class
mm-hmm.
here, but he would talk for the entire class period, and that was the only interaction. We sat there and we took notes
mm-hmm.
and we tried to listen. This was a late afternoon class.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's talk about what you see are the components in an effective lesson, and it can be in any discipline.
Right, and that model of the teacher just lecturing, I'm not going to say that it's a bad model because
okay.
all of us learned under it.
Mm-hmm.
But you know very well that there were teachers who could lecture and keep you engaged,
mm-hmm.
and there were teachers who lectured and you went to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to use the lecture model,
mm-hmm.
first of all, you only do it for a part of the time. You do
okay.
not do that for the entire lesson
right.
in a high school class
sure.
every single
sure.
day. But when you do use it, it needs to be an interactive
mm-hmm.
process. There are things like Cornell notes that help the students to learn how to take notes because
okay.
they are going to have to do that when they go to college.
Sure.
But it also allows time for the students to engage with the content, and
mm-hmm.
That's a specific strategy
mm-hmm.
that can be used so that teachers can become more interactive
mm-hmm.
and make the learning more about the student
mm-hmm.
doing the work rather than the teacher doing
okay.
the work. You also want to do as much group work as you can,
mm-hmm.
but not in the same way and in the same with
okay.
the same groups on
sure.
a daily basis.
Sure.
You want to see students use pair working
mm-hmm.
so that they can talk to each other in their own language and personalize their learning.
Mm-hmm.
You want to see them using groups to
mm-hmm.
help scaffold learning for
okay.
one another. So, for example, if you pair an excellent student with one who is struggling,
uh-huh.
that can be beneficial both to the excellent
okay.
student who's learning how to state what they've learned.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that 90% of what you teach, you remember. So
yes.
having the students be the teachers
mm-hmm.
helps them immensely.
Okay.
And often that message is received better
mm-hmm.
by a struggling student if it's coming from another student.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you can group them by interest.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we used to do that when we did our Constitution unit. We always had students select a topic that they
mm-hmm.
wanted to write a new law
mm-hmm.
about.
Oh, good.
So we grouped them by interest.
Mm-hmm.
And that is sometimes the way you want to group them as well. But there should be some opportunity mm-hmm. for group work mm-hmm. sometime during the lesson. Mm-hmm.
And I see what you've mentioned about the various types of groups as maybe a question that a teacher might, you know, you say, well, you should use group work. Okay, so how do I form the groups? And so that's part of the learning experience. And the other thing I heard you say is that students really need to learn how to learn, you know,
yes.
like learning how to take notes. Okay. Without mentioning names, subjects, or anything else, how do you measure improvement in teacher success over time? I mean, you yourself personally, subjective, objective, besides the Danielson, what do you see that tells you things are really working?
Well, one of the things that's in Danielson that helps teachers see that is what's called a student learning objective.
Mm-hmm.
Every teacher has to create a student learning objective for the year.
Okay.
And by setting a specific thing that you're going to work on
mm-hmm.
and then measuring how your students are doing on it
mm-hmm.
and measuring them again at the end of the year, you can see whether what you're doing is making a difference
mm-hmm.
or not. I know that if I were in the classroom right now,
mm-hmm.
my SLO would be student writing.
Okay.
I believe that if we get our students to write,
mm-hmm.
first we're engaging them.
Yeah.
Secondly, by them explaining their learning,
mm-hmm.
it's a powerful tool that
sure.
you are giving your students.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what content
yeah.
it is.
Mm-hmm.
They can't hide behind multiple choice questions
good.
If you're making them write
mm-hmm.
what they know.
Mm-hmm.
And you can very easily determine what it is they know and what they don't know
mm-hmm.
by using writing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would be where my efforts would be
okay.
at this point if I were in the classroom.
Okay.
It's a lifelong skill that our students
sure.
need to learn.
Yeah, okay. We have maybe 3 minutes here, and I would just like to have you reflect on your experience at Park High School so far. Coincidentally, I've been here several times to talk to people at Park, and, you know, I have two reasons for it. Number one, I know people here, and the other reason is maybe I think you'll be able to identify for me. So let's talk about you and Park High School. And this is really your year, you know, you started this at the beginning of the school year. So tell me about you and Park High School.
Well, the very same thing that happened when I walked into Mitchell
mm-hmm.
happened when I walked in here to Park.
Mm-hmm.
I felt immediately at home.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of the students that come to Park came from Mitchell,
mm-hmm.
so I already knew quite a few of
yeah.
the juniors and seniors,
mm-hmm.
But just felt that, yes, this is my group of students.
Okay, yeah.
And the staff here is unbelievable
mm-hmm.
at welcoming,
mm-hmm.
making me feel at home,
mm-hmm.
And the classrooms that I have visited, I've seen some spectacular
okay,
teaching.
Good.
I love it here. I
okay.
feel right at home.
Okay.
I feel very welcome.
Okay.
I feel appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
So this has been a real good placement
okay.
for me.
Okay. Do you know, I mean, you've been here for 1 year, but do you feel that the staff here is transient, like in for a few years and then someplace else, or do you feel that people come here and they grow in their professional skills and they stay? Now, this is, you know, it's kind of a random out of left field question, but what are your thoughts about that?
Most of the people that I talk to who have been here for a while have no plans on going anywhere
okay.
else.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason I'm seeing people wish to leave, well, and they're not wishing to leave,
mm-hmm.
if their position is cut,
oh, yeah.
is the only reason I'm seeing people
mm-hmm.
wanting to
mm-hmm.
leave. As a matter of fact, we have a number of people who have stayed way past what is considered normal retirement age. And they don't want to go.
They don't want to go, yeah.
They want to stay.
Wow.
Which is a testament, I think,
okay.
to this building.
Okay. That's a good note on which to close. We're out of time. The Metropolitan Opera is coming right up. That's
Ooh,
why we're
having... Ooh, want me to sing,
too? We'll keep the mic on. That's why we did a 30-minute show today. But Connie, I thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you and kind of revisiting old times and where education is right now, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much. It's always fun to see you, John.
Thank you. John Nicholson for Education Matters. Have a good day.
Support for WGTD comes from Carthage College, combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities is available online at carthage.edu.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Racine Theater Guild will be having an adult tap dancing class running Saturdays from April 4th to May 16th. They will be a 9 a.m. and a 10 a.m. class. To register, visit the theater or dial 262-633-4218.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
We're live at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York City. I'm Mary Jo Heath in for Margaret Chuntwaite. And for this Saturday matinee, we bring you the most famous bel canto tragedy, Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor. Soprano Albina Shagamuratova and tenor Joseph Kalea are the star-crossed lovers Lucia and Edgardo. The cast also features baritone Luca Salsi and bass Alistair Miles, with maestro Maurizio Benini conducting. During intermission, we'll take you backstage to speak with our stars, and we'll bring you the opera quiz featuring soprano Barbara Fritoli. Stay with us.
This performance is being broadcast live over the Toll Brothers Metropolitan Opera International Radio Network, sponsored by Toll Brothers, America's luxury home builder, with generous long-term support from the Annenberg Foundation, the Neubauer Family Foundation, the Vincent A. Stabile Endowment for Broadcast Media, and through contributions from listeners worldwide.
I'm Mary Jo Heath in for Margaret Chuntwaite, and I'm joined by commentator Ira Siff for Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor, the ever-popular bel canto drama.
Yes, other tragedies from that era have gone in and out of fashion, but Lucia's always captivated audiences throughout the 180 years since it was written. The story is simple, but it's compelling, about doomed lovers from feuding clans, and it's told through highly expressive music that invites expressive performances.
Yeah, in particular, the mad scene for the title character is a tour de force. So many great divas have brought it to life on our stage, and it's always exciting to hear a new one.
Well, Lucia is the quintessential vulnerable romantic heroine. Her music has everything: dramatic power, lyrical tenderness, flights of coloratura expressing joy, sorrow, anger.
Yeah, it's quite spectacular. Well, like Rossini's La Donna del Lago, which we heard just 2 weeks ago, Lucia di Lammermoor is based on a work by Sir Walter Scott, and it's set in Scotland. So here's what happens in the first act. Lucia's brother Enrico fears that his family's fortunes are in sharp decline. Lucia has refused a marriage that could save them from financial and political ruin. The chaplain Raimondo believes this is because she's mourning the recent death of her mother. But the captain of the guard blurts out his suspicion that Lucia is in love with their enemy, Edgardo of Ravenswood. In the next scene, Lucia waits by a fountain for a tryst with Edgardo. She tells her companion, Elisa, how one night, by that very fountain, she saw the ghost of a girl who was murdered there by a jealous lover. Edgardo arrives and breaks the news that he must depart for France on a political matter. But before he leaves, he wants to make peace with Lucia's brother so he can ask for her hand in marriage. Lucia fears this is impossible and asks him to wait. They exchange rings, swearing to be true to each other. Edgardo declares, "Heaven joins us together," and they bid each other farewell as the act ends. Ira, as you said, it's a simple story, but it's rich with details of characterization and emotion. So let's talk about those some more along with the music. For example, the exposition in the opening scene is so vivid, the way it presents the bitterness between these two families.
Right. We get not just information, but a very strong sense of Enrico's ruthlessness. From the first driving chords of his aria, we hear his determination and his intense rage at what he feels is Lucia's betrayal. His melody is powerful, loaded with exciting high notes, and the cabaletta is accompanied by a pulsing rhythm as he declares that pity is out of the question.
Yeah, it sets us up to feel sympathetic and protective towards Lucia, and the delicate harp music that opens her scene just reinforces that. Her fragile state of mind comes through in her aria, a ghost story.
And the ghost is very real to Lucia, and it's worth noting that it was one of Edgardo's ancestors who killed the girl. Listen for the trills in this aria. They're shivers of horror as Lucia remembers seeing the ghost and watching the water of the fountain turn blood red.
But then her emotions swing from one extreme to the other for the Cabaletta, as she talks about the joy that Edgardo's love brings her.
Right, and here the trills are shivers of bliss, along with quicksilver scales and soaring high notes, and they all illustrate her ecstasy.
Edgardo loves Lucia in spite of his intense hatred for her family. We learn that her brother was responsible for the death of Edgardo's father and for the ruin of his family.
Yes, Edgardo's music is bitter as he describes this, but Lucia's vocal line rises above it, tender and placating. This duet gives us a clear picture of how torn Lucia is. She's caught between her lover and her brother.
But the music is joyful as she and Edgardo declare themselves united in the eyes of God. And then it settles into a love theme.
Right. First it's sung by her, then him, then both together. It's exquisite and inescapably memorable. It's a sort of early example of a leitmotif, actually, because it will reappear later in the opera as a vivid reminder of their happiness together and their vows of fidelity.
Well, the opera is originally set in the 1700s, and Donizetti wrote it in 1835, but our production by Mary Zimmerman moves it up to the Victorian era, a few decades after Donizetti's time. We'll hear in order of vocal appearance Eduardo Valdez as Normano, the captain of the guard, Luca Salsi as Enrico, Alistair Miles as Raimondo, and Albina Shagamuratova as Lucia. Theodora Hanslow is Elisa, and Joseph Kalea is Edgardo. The harp solo is performed by Mariko Anraku. Our concertmaster today is Laura Hamilton, with Maurizio Benigni conducting the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra and chorus. So yes, we are set in sort of Victorian ghost stories
were really very popular in the Victorian period, you know, and this staging, we actually see the ghost that Lucia sings about.
And right now we're looking at the show curtain, which has these bare tree branches against a gray sky. Mary Zimmerman, the director, said that kind of was exposed raw nerve endings to her, those show curtains. Here's Maestro Benigni. Let's hear Act One of Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor.
Thank you. Mi fa gelare il freddo. Sol.